Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Board proposes to terminate Riddick's contract. Tuesday's 7-0 vote continues process of removing superintendent by Stuart Doreen. The methodical termination of Midland ISD's superintendent will continue. The school district board voted 7-0 Tuesday on the termination of the contract of Superintendent Orlando Riddick. The proposal and vote on the item followed another multi-hour executive session discussing Riddick's evaluation and then his removal after 3 years as the district superintendent. MISD leaders stated last week that there is a process school board members must follow as Riddick's contract isn't set to expire until June 30, 2022. Last week, the district stated the following in an email. The board would first take action to propose mid-contract termination. That happened Tuesday. The superintendent then would be provided written notice that includes the reasons for termination. He then has 15 days to request a hearing from an independent hearing examiner. If he does not request a hearing, the board could then take final action at the next board meeting. District 2 Representative Robert Marquez made the motion to propose the termination of Mr. Orlando Riddick's superintendent's contract during the contract term for good cause and further authorized the board president to prepare and finalize any related notices required by law or policy and to schedule a hearing if requested and do all other things necessary related to preparing for and holding such hearing. District 4 Representative John Kennedy seconded the motion, and the board unanimously approved the item. The Midland ISD board went into executive session for longer than 2.5 hours Tuesday night, bringing the total time in executive session over 3 meetings, going back to August 17th, to more than 10 hours. 3 people called into the public comment portion of the meeting, all supportive of the superintendent. Those callers included Eddie Rabb, the president of the local chapter of the NAACP, who told the board it takes more than 3 years for a superintendent to implement his program. He was critical of the idea of spending money to hire another agency to find another leader. He also questioned the need to change leadership during a pandemic. He finished his comments saying, "I hope we don't have to take this any further." A caller by the name of Matthew Johns identified himself as a teacher with 14 years of experience in the district. A Midland ISD roster shows a person with the same name was a world geography teacher at Midland Freshman High School last year. Johns questioned the need to drag the superintendent through such a long process and that extending it over multiple meetings gave the appearance of it being handled in an indecisive and meandered manner. He questioned how it could be determined that Riddick's performance was any different than the 2018-19 school year since there wasn't state testing in 2019-20, and posed the question that the decision to remove Riddick was, quote, a desperate attempt to right a ship you helped crash, unquote. He also said removing the superintendent in such a manner impacts the district's ability to find a high-quality replacement. The third person said that Midlanders don't give up, and the board should rally around the superintendent and allow him to lead the district to a better place. This article is entitled, Hospital CEO, COVID-19 Situation is Improving, by Stuart Doreen. The number of coronavirus tests being taken at Midland Health facilities is showing a nearly two-thirds decline in the percentage of positive results. Midland Health CEO Russell Myers said Tuesday that the hospital statistics show the number of tests taken went from 625 during the July 4th week to 425 this past week. Also, the number of people testing positive fell from 36% around July 4th to 12.5% this past week. So things are improving, Myers said. And really the only explanation for that is the increased diligence in the community to maintain physical separation, mask wearing, etc. The results also show that last week, The Midland Health Department reported the lowest number of new coronavirus cases in Midland County in about 2 months. And the 12 coronavirus cases reported Monday was an 80% drop week over week, and the lowest number of positive tests on a Monday going back at least 2 months. The Monday report is when the hospital announces cases from testing over the weekend or test results received during the weekend. Other statistics Myers reported during the weekly press event included the COVID-19 census at Midland Memorial Hospital is at 14, 5 in critical care and 9 in the COVID unit. The age spread of these inpatients are 30s to 80s for those in critical care and 30s to 90s for those in the COVID ward. Myers said the census includes 3 residents of Ashton Medical Lodge. We haven't seen a very high census now for several days, but we are continuing to keep COVID beds in reserve, he said. Myers said the next few weeks provide different risk factors in the community's fight with coronavirus, including the opening of schools and exposure to staff and teachers. Midland ISD later announced more details Tuesday on its phase-in program to bring students back on campus. The potential for a spike also exists because of the Labor Day weekend, as occurred after Memorial Day holiday, and because flu season is set to begin, Myers said. This article is entitled ECISD, Midland Man Being Held on Charge of Improper Relationship. District Says Teacher is on Paid Administrative Leave, by Mary Deeren. A Midland man who is on paid administrative leave from Ector County ISD was being held at Midland County Jail Tuesday night on a charge of improper relationship between educator and student, according to a press release from the district. Bond for William H. Boone had not been set as of Tuesday night. ECISD police began an investigation earlier this month after 2 former students of Odessa Collegiate Academy reported that a teacher and a student at the school had been involved in an improper relationship during the spring semester, according to the release. The teacher, Boone, was immediately placed on paid administrative leave. The investigation culminated in Boone's arrest Tuesday on the second-degree felony. This is extremely disturbing, ECISD Superintendent Scott Murray said in the release. We are angry. Inappropriate behavior will not be tolerated. As a school district, we have taken steps to combat this. We require sexual harassment training each year, and this training includes very clear warnings of the consequences for employee-student relationships. There is no excuse for our employees to misunderstand the seriousness of these actions. We want you, our staff, our parents, and our community to know we will continue to do everything we can to prevent this behavior. I want to add, we are extremely thankful for our teachers, the 99.9% of them who are committed to helping kids every day, Murray said. Boone began teaching in ECISD in August 2000 and has worked at Crockett Middle School in addition to OCA with no previous complaints, according to the release. This article is entitled Environmental Unit to Stay with DA's Office by Caitlin Randall. The Midland County Commissioner's Court on Tuesday voted to keep the county's Environmental Enforcement Unit and Bomb Dog under the District Attorney's Office after County Judge Terry Johnston previously moved those units to other departments in his proposed county budget. The decisions came during a Commissioner's Court meeting that began Monday and continued all day Tuesday, when the court heard requests from department heads regarding the proposed 2021 budget, including District Attorney Laura Nodolf. Nodolf asked that the Bomb Dog, which was moved to the Sheriff's Office in the proposed budget, and the Environmental Enforcement Unit, which had been moved to the Emergency Management Department, remain with her office. The Bomb Dog could not be moved to another department, according to Nodolf, because it was purchased with forfeiture funds or money seized from people who have been arrested that the District Attorney's Office received from the state. Some private donations were collected for the canine unit, but those were used for supplies and training and not the purchase of the dog itself, Nodolf said. She acknowledged that the dog's handler could be moved to the sheriff's office, but said, "A handler without a dog and a dog without a handler is not a canine bomb detection team." The handler, investigator Kevin Bullard, would also be required to go through the process of getting recertified as a bomb technician if he were removed, she said. A motion to keep the canine bomb unit with the district attorney's office passed 3-1, with Johnson casting the dissenting vote and Commissioner Luis Sanchez abstaining from voting. Nodolf then gave a presentation on her request to keep the environmental enforcement unit under her department. Sanchez raised concerns about that unit staying with the district attorney's office, in part, he said, because he felt the commissioner's court was not kept updated on the work the unit is doing. He also said he did not agree with the unit's policy to receive only complaints from the public through an online form, saying his constituents had told him some environmental crimes were not being reported because individuals did not want to use the online platform. Some of the folks I spoke to, their exact words to me is, "You guys aren't going to do anything about it anyway," Sanchez said. So what I had to do was go ahead and call my constable and say, "Hey, can you guys go take a look at this?" Nodolf said she already had made changes to the unit based on earlier conversations she's had with Sanchez and would continue to make changes to the unit based on the commissioner's feedback. A motion to keep the environmental enforcement unit with the district attorney's office passed 4-1, with Sanchez casting the dissenting vote. This is the local page. This article is entitled "Midland ISD to Start Phase-In Process Monday" by Stuart Doreen. Midland ISD students will start the phase-in process Monday. The district announced Tuesday that in the first phase, pre-K students and self-contained students, according to their individualized education programs, for all grades will be back on campus daily beginning on Monday. The second phase is set for September 8th, when kindergartners through second graders and Midland Alternative Program students return to campus Monday through Friday. On that day, 6th and 7th grade students at Young Women's Leadership Academy and San Jacinto Junior High School return for blended instruction. The model allows students to be divided into two groups, A and B. One group is on campus while the other remains at home for online instruction. 7th grade students at Abel, Alamo, and Goddard Junior High Schools also start blended instruction that day. The remaining students in 3rd through 12th grade return for blended instruction on September 15th, which is the third phase. Midland ISD also reported Tuesday that all students enrolled in the Midland ISD Online Academy will continue with fully virtual learning. The phase-in process will be gradual as we move from fully at-home instruction to blended learning instruction, according to the district in a press release. Families of students returning to blended instruction will receive additional information from their home campuses. This is in line with plans that the district previously announced regarding the variety of instructional models made available depending on the spread of COVID-19. The decision to return to the classroom is a reflection of reduced spread of COVID in our community in recent weeks. For more information, visit midlandisd.net/fall2020. Phase 1, Monday. On campus, Monday through Friday. Pre-K students, self-contained students according to their IEP for all grades. Phase 2, September 8th. On campus Monday through Friday, pre-K and second grade students, self-contained students according to their IEP for all grades, MAP, DDAEP students. AB schedule, blended instruction model. 6th through 7th graders at YWLA and San Jacinto Junior High, 7th graders at Abel, Alamo, and Goddard Junior High Schools. Phase 3, September 15th, on campus Monday through Friday, pre-K through second grade students, self-contained students according to their IEP for all grades, MAP, DDAEP students, AB schedule, blended instruction model, all 3rd through 6th grade students, all 7th through 8th grade students, all 9th through 12th grade students. This article is entitled "City Could Allow TABC to Take Lead on Alcohol Service" by Stuart Doreen. City leaders had a discussion Tuesday about the local regulation of the sale of alcoholic beverages for on-premises consumption. A motion is likely to appear before the Midland City Council that states those businesses that serve alcohol, both bars and restaurants, will be regulated by Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission rules. The topic brought up most is the time when alcohol can be served. Currently, when a business comes before the city, it proposes hours when it will serve alcohol as part of the specific use permit process. Those hours are then approved by city leaders and sometimes amended. An example is that city leaders require that on Sundays, alcohol can be served beginning at 11 a.m. TABC allows alcoholic beverages to be sold on Sunday from noon to midnight, but establishments that serve food can begin selling alcohol at 10 a.m. Also, if an establishment is in a city or county where it is legal for late hours and the business has a late hours permit, it can sell alcohol for on-premise consumption until 2 a.m. any night of the week. If it is earlier on Sunday, we're going to get calls on it, Councilman Spencer Robnett said during the briefing session that preceded the council meeting. It will be the movie theater thing all over again. The legal hours of sale/service of alcoholic beverages are 7 a.m. to midnight Monday through Friday and 7 a.m. to 1 a.m. Saturday. Again, if an establishment is in a city or county where it is legal for late hours and the business has a late hours permit, it can sell alcohol for on-premise consumption until 2 a.m. any night of the week. The city will retain rules and regulations where an establishment serving alcohol can be located. It was stated during the briefing session that the city deals with about 40 special use permits a year that allow for the service of alcohol. City officials said there will be a pro-business impact making this change, including that using TABC regulations would keep the zoning process moving, reduce restrictions Midland has, eliminate expenses, and eliminate public hearings. City officials also stated that Midland's current ordinance doesn't refer to hours of operation, thus leaving the city open to operators that could challenge it. Before bringing any changes before the council, city officials will attempt to make sure that any repeal of current special use permits are done globally. This article is entitled Midland City Council Slashes Budget, Approves No New Revenue Tax Rate by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council has cut its budget and dropped its tax rate. The Council approved on first reading its $135.391 million general fund budget and a no new revenue tax rate. City staff dropped the general budget by more than $1 million, and the tax rate decreased from 36.402 cents per $100 valuation to 35.8928. The city held a public hearing on both the tax rate and the budget Tuesday during the council meeting. City staff reported Tuesday that the proposed tax rate will bring $60.092 million into the city coffers, including $50.124 million into the general fund and nearly $10 million for debt service. The Texas Comptroller's Office reports that the no new revenue tax rate enables the public to evaluate the relationship between taxes for the previous year and for the current year based on a tax rate that would produce the same amount of taxes if applied to the properties taxed in both years. This is the COVID-19 page. This article is entitled COVID Numbers Still Down. City Reports 65th Death from Staff Reports. The number of new coronavirus cases rose to 40 on Tuesday, but the Midland Health Department reports that confirmed cases are still down week over week. Through Tuesday of last week, the Health Department reported 65 cases, which means there are 13 fewer through 2 days this week, according to statistics provided by the Health Department. Tuesday's cases brought the total to 52 this week and are reflective of lab results from Monday, according to the city. There are 1,097 isolated cases and 421 under investigation for a total of 1,518 active cases. The number of people who have recovered, according to the health department, rose by 24 on Tuesday to 1,391. There were 161 people who the health department had been unable to locate or who refused to provide an update.
The city also reported Tuesday the county's 65th death. The patient was a man in his 40s with underlying health conditions. He was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital and died on August 19th, according to the press release. Coronavirus report. Cases Monday, 12. Tuesday, 40. Total cases, 3,094.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, August 26, 2020. New habitat duties. Joey Hopkins, Midland Habitat for Humanity Executive Director, seen at a project site on November 2, 2018, has been named to the board of Habitat for Humanity, Texas. Midland Habitat Executive Director named to State Board. The Executive Director of Midland Habitat for Humanity has been named to the Board of Directors of Habitat for Humanity, Texas. Joey Hopkins is one of six new members on the 12-member board, according to a press release from Texas Habitat. Through this board service, I hope to help other Texas Habitat affiliates reach their goals and ultimately help get more families in homes, Hopkins said in a statement. He has been executive director of the local nonprofit since 2018. Y needs volunteers for virtual learning. These select area volunteer opportunities and events are provided by MSS Connections, a program of MSS made possible by the Warren Charitable Foundation. For more information, visit mssconnections.org. The Midland YMCA needs volunteers during virtual learning. Volunteers will be needed to help kids log in to their computers, answer questions, and transfer kids from one area to another. Volunteers are needed 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. weekdays and can pick the time and day. Contact is Amy Evans, aevans@midlandymca.org. Permian Basin Petroleum Museum needs volunteers for Family Science Night. Volunteers will help prepare supplies for the Family Science Night to-go boxes. Contact education@petroleummuseum.org with any questions. Midland Children's Rehabilitation Center looking for volunteers for hippotherapy. Volunteers walk alongside the horses while therapists conduct the sessions. Call 498-2053 or email cgoebel@midlandchildrens.org. Helping Hands of Midland has multiple volunteer opportunities. Clean the store and restrooms, sort and file books, stock and organize housewares, unload trucks and sort donated items, sort, hang, bale, and stock donated clothing items. Contact Mary Harden at 528-6265 or mhardin.hhm@gmail.com. Health Department is providing services. The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Monday through Friday. In addition, the Health Department will have immunization clinics 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday and September 12 and 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. September 21. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613. Firefighters doing virtual fill the boot. The International Association of Firefighters and Professional Firefighters Association of Midland Local 4405 is doing a virtual fill the boot, which will take the place of the annual in-person campaign for the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Instead of placing donations in boots held up by Midland firefighters at intersections across Midland, residents can donate at fillthebootdonordrive.com/participant/Midland. The virtual campaign continues through the end of the year, said Greg Wells with Midland Local 4405. Their goal is $5,000, according to the website. When it's open, Midland County Public Library, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, for students, 8:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. Monday through Friday. Curbside pickup at Downtown Branch, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. Today in Texas history. In 2017, Hurricane Harvey spun into Texas, unloading extraordinary amounts of rain. The hurricane killed nearly 70 people, damaged more than 300,000 structures, and caused an estimated $125 billion in damage.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Media Has People Thinking Wrong About COVID, by Emily Oster, special to the Washington Post. Last summer, a swimmer in Maine was killed by a shark. This tragic event was widely reported by local and national media. It was news. But the fact that there are hardly ever shark attacks in the United States is not news, because we expect most days to pass without shark-related fatalities. Researchers have documented our preference for the unexpected, exploring how information that is, quote, surprising, unquote, provides greater entertainment and attracts more attention. Often this is benign. A basketball game that ends in a stunning upset, for example, gets more coverage than a routine blowout. When it comes to COVID-19, however, this preference and the media's tendency to indulge it presents a real danger. It warps our thinking about the pandemic and may be leading us toward irrational decisions that can cause lasting harm. The problem is that reporting on COVID-19 tends to follow the shark attack example. We're unaccustomed to what the virus has wrought. Hospitals overwhelmed, celebrities and world leaders suffering near-death experiences in the public eye. These surprises are what the media focuses on. The challenge with the novel coronavirus, however, is exactly that. It's completely novel. Nothing about it should be expected. All of the ways it behaves and doesn't behave are new. In that sense, a nursing home with zero infections should be just as newsworthy as a nursing home with several. Because of the overwhelming bias in what gets reported about COVID-19, the public lacks essential context for making reasoned, well-informed decisions. Researchers found, for example, that droplets containing the virus can, in theory, travel far in the air. That discovery was widely reported. Overlooked was the fact that even if droplets can travel far in the air, we don't have evidence that they usually do. So hiking trails and other open-air facilities were closed, despite the fact there are no documented cases of COVID-19 caused by hiking. Then there is the debate surrounding schools. Districts in many areas are still grappling with whether to reopen, or when and how, with plenty of accompanying media coverage. Nearly all of it focuses on examples of COVID-19 infections, but the uncertainty surrounding the coronavirus means the same attention should be given to schools where there are no cases. Twitter is full of people saying, "My kid's school opened without any cases this week." Data I've collected shows that there are many camps and childcare facilities, even larger ones, operating without any confirmed cases. These examples are out there, they just don't show up in headlines. Parents and policymakers influenced by this skewed reporting may naturally conclude that any in-person instruction is dangerous. But they are missing a key piece of the puzzle. There are 291 school districts in Indiana serving 1 million children. Several have been open since July, even if, by one count, there have been 100 cases in Indiana schools so far. This is likely to be a low in-school infection rate. Beyond that, this fact doesn't tell us anything about whether infection spread in schools. In the absence of complete information on risks, our overreactions can have serious consequences. One example is the Three Mile Island nuclear event, which has not been conclusively linked to any long-term negative health outcomes, but did terrify Americans about nuclear power. People simply didn't have enough baseline information about the number of nuclear plants operating safely on a given day to realize that the probability of a nuclear disaster was vanishingly small. The result was that nuclear power, a plentiful, carbon-free energy source, never reached its potential in the United States, leading to needless over-reliance on dangerous fossil fuels. We risk making similar mistakes with the coronavirus. Keeping children out of school harms their development. Shuttering businesses destroys livelihoods. These downsides may be offset by the benefits of limiting COVID-19, but we cannot rationally assess the trade-offs when we only have partial information. What we really need to know is not the anecdotes that news reports provide, but the full picture. What share of schools have cases? Moreover, what differentiates places with cases from those without? Is it difference in prevention measures, demographic and economic characteristics, the presence of community spread events? To answer these questions, we need systematic data collection and reporting, the sort that lets us evaluate risks in all kinds of situations, from driving cars to flying on planes to, yes, ocean swimming. It should be possible to do this. As schools open, districts will have counts of at least detected COVID-19 cases, as well as information on the overall enrolled population. This data could be combined in public databases with user-friendly dashboards and maps. Since this type of data collection has not been spearheaded by central authorities, I've partnered with a set of national education organizations and a data team to try to put it together. Once we have a dashboard for these data, the media could use these sources to drive their coverage. Even if they chose not to, because day 45 with infection rate below 0.01% doesn't generate a lot of clicks, citizens would be empowered to analyze the relevant information themselves. With data like this widely available, we could make good, or at least better, choices about who should open and when. Emily Oster is a professor of economics at Brown University. This column is called Guest View. It is entitled, It's Past Time to Force Big Tech to Change, from the Dallas Morning News. Internet reform that once seemed all but impossible now seems inevitable. Most Americans have concerns about the size, reach, and business practices of big tech, from Facebook to Amazon and to Apple. And so do the smarter members of Congress, regardless of party. The question now isn't whether there should be reform. It is what reform should look like. There are many directions reform could go, and many watching believe the right direction is tackling big tech size and supposedly anti-competitive practices. We don't think so. Technology shifts fast. Tech companies, especially those that are basically web-based applications versus software or hardware companies, could be undermined more quickly than many suppose. No true reform needs to focus on the way U.S. law allowed the internet to grow. And that means changing how big tech has been able to take advantage of the law to create outrageous scale, even as its products have metastasized social and political division, helped manipulate elections, spread child sex imagery, and facilitated online fraud. Whatever the outcome of the November election, reforming the internet with a particular eye toward how the internet and especially how social media function must be a primary goal of the government, without a partisan agenda. At least one bill is now on the table that is, at last, a serious effort. It comes from Senator Josh Hawley, Republican, Missouri, who recently authored a bill to have the Chinese app TikTok removed from government phones. That wise legislation passed the Senate unanimously. Now Hawley is urging Congress to finally reform what is known as the Founding Clause of the Internet, Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. That law frees Internet platforms from liability for material disseminated through their sites or on their platforms. Hawley's bill would remove Section 230 immunity from Internet companies that track users, create profiles, and serve up targeted ads in what's known as behavioral advertising. We have long argued that social media companies in particular should not have carte blanche to disseminate the libelous and criminal material that pollutes their sites. But those companies, in the impossible arrogance born of their immunity, have done little to correct their bad actions, even as their coffers ballooned through ad sales, while traditional publishers, retailers, and much of the creative economy withered. Only of late, and under the most intense pressure, are these companies offering fig leaf efforts at self-reform. It's too little too late. As Hawley said, big tech's manipulative advertising regime comes with a massive hidden price tag for consumers while providing almost no return to anyone but themselves. Hawley's bill isn't perfect. Considerations need to be made for how search engines should function, for example, perhaps by abandoning behavioral advertising. Perfect or not, the bill is a start in a real debate that this country needs to have, outside of partisan considerations, of how we tame the monster we created. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the obituary column,
Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. Francisco Quico Sanchez. Francisco Quico Sanchez, 93 years old, passed away Monday, August 24th, 2020. Quico was born September 17th, 1926, in Durango, Mexico, to Luz Olave Zambrano and Francisco Sanchez. Beloved husband of the late Ermila Sanchez, he is survived by his children, Mario Sanchez of Midland, Cecilia Camarillo and her husband, Joe James Camarillo of Austin, Martha Loftus and her husband, Jack Loftus of League City, and Jesus Sanchez of Amarillo. He is also survived by one sister, Socorro Solis Olave of Juarez, Mexico, seven wonderful grandchildren, and a number of nieces and nephews. Due to the current pandemic, a private service and burial will be held for the immediate family. We will plan a celebration of his life at a future date. Viewing will be Wednesday, August 26th from 5 to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. A funeral mass will be Thursday, August 27th at 2 p.m. at St. Stephen's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Hazel Marie Weeks Lovell. Hazel Marie Meeks Lovell, 89, of Midland, passed away on August 17, 2020. A celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. on August 29th at Nally Pickle and Welch Chapel in Midland, Texas. Hazel was born to C.W. Claudie and Tenny Mae Meeks in Tahoka, Texas on November 21st, 1930. She met B.J. Billy Lovell while he was working in the oil fields around Tahoka. They married August 25th, 1949, and enjoyed 71 years together until his death May 6, 2020. She is survived by her children, Mike Lovell, Cynthia, Danny Lovell, Marva, daughter-in-law Chris Lovell, and sister-in-law Jean Meeks. She is also survived by five grandchildren, nine great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband, and siblings, Othel Meeks, Winnie Dodson, Darnell Bailey, Claudie Jr. Meeks, and Earlene Meeks. She is also preceded in death by her son, Jim Lovell, daughter Janice Lorene Lovell, and one great-grandchild. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorial be donated to John F. Younger Alzheimer's Care Unit, 2208 North Loop 250 West, Midland, Texas, 79707, or a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Trinidad Loera Hernandez. Trinidad Loera Hernandez passed away on Thursday, August 20th, 2020, at the age of 94. Trinidad, a.k.a. Trini to her family and friends, was born on August 15th, 1926, in El Mulato Chi, Mexico, to Filomeno Larez Ramos and Jesus Loera. She married Baudelio M. Hernandez on December 21st, 1946, in La Mula Chi, Mexico. She is preceded in death by her parents, her husband Baudelio, her son Sergeant Jesus L. Hernandez of the U.S. Army during Vietnam War, two daughters who passed during infancy, her brothers Gregorio and Octavio Loera, her two sisters Florentina Garcia and Delia Loera. She is survived by her children Gloria Malacara Beta, Antonio L. Hernandez, Rose Suchil Santiago, Marta Hernandez, Juliet Chavez Renee, William Mimo, Kathleen Hernandez. She is also survived by her sisters Catalina Loera and Socorro Vargas, numerous cousins, nieces, and nephews. Trinidad had 17 grandchildren and 33 great-grandchildren and one great-great-granddaughter. Pallbearers will be her grandsons. The family would like to thank the nurses at Midland Memorial Hospital and the staff at Ashton Medical Lodge for risking their lives and providing special care to our beloved. A visitation will be held from 5 to 9 p.m. with a rosary at 6 p.m. at Ella's Funeral Home on Thursday, August 27th.
funeral mass will be held at St. Anne's Catholic Church on Friday, August 28th at 10 a.m. with a graveside service to follow at Fairview Cemetery. Death notices. Alan Thomas Mercer. Alan Thomas Mercer, 87, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, August 25th in Midland. Visitation will be 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 27th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Funeral service will be 2 p.m. Friday, August 28th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Doris A. Shanks. Doris A. Shanks, 85, of Midland, passed away August 23, 2020. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 28th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 29th at Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Francis Anderson. Francis Anderson, 81, of Odessa, passed from this life on August 20th, 2020, in Odessa. She was born to the late Frank and Mary Rodriguez, June 17th, 1939, in Refugio, Texas. She is survived by her children, Gloria Beerley, John Frank Robles, Gracie Smith, Angela Boyles, and Roland Robles, two siblings and numerous grandchildren. A funeral service will be held Wednesday, August 26th at 2 p.m., with burial following immediately at Fairview Cemetery. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Keith Davis. Keith Davis, 66, of Odessa, passed away August 23rd, 2020. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, August 28th at Sunset Memorial Garden Cemetery in Odessa. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, August 26th. Odessa Strong, 1 year later. Angels watching over him. Native Californian says he is one of the lucky ones. The story was written by Laura Dennis. Joe Glide is a spiritual man who praises the 10 angels always watching over him. He also declares that he has more lives than 9 cats. It could be a bit of both, as Glide, who continually calls himself one of the lucky ones, was a victim of the murderous rampage of slain gunman Seth Ator last August 31st in Odessa. Ator would gun down 7 and wound 25 others on that hot Saturday on Labor Day weekend last year. Glide was shot while he was driving from the airport to Odessa on Interstate 20. In front of him, he would see an orange truck wildly careering off the interstate and hit a pole after the gunman shot that driver. Law enforcement later tell him the man in the orange truck had died. It was, in fact, that truck lunging to the side of the road that made Clyde question what was going on around him. Had he just heard shots? Why were so many cops and troopers dashing down the interstate? Where were all the cops going? Looking back, he quietly says that, remarkably, the 2 bullets that struck him bled very little. He wasn't even aware he had been shot, let alone shot multiple times. He would glance at the door and see bullet holes. It all became clear to him. The driver of the orange truck had been shot. Clyde was shot as well. He would pull up near DPS troopers and at least one Odessa Police Department officer, a former soldier who Clyde credits with triaging him, but whose name he does not know, and roll down his window to tell them that he thought he had been shot. He certainly had. One bullet traveled from the left of his abdomen across his stomach and would stay lodged there until Dr. Donald Davenport would remove it later that day during surgery at Medical Center Hospital. The angels and cat lives were at work as that bullet missed all his vital organs. A second bullet entered and exited his left leg, severing nerves and leaving the leg partially numb to this day. A third bullet would not hit Clyde, but instead would damage his thick wallet and lodge itself into what might have become somewhat of a macabre souvenir that strangers, kinfolk, and friends ask to see when the subject of August 31st, 2019 comes up. He's gentlemanly when asked to produce that wallet with the strange hole in it. The bullet, taken by an FBI agent last year as evidence, is long gone, but the brown leather wallet bears the hole as testament to his 10 angels or 9 times 9 cat lives. After the triage from the OPD officer, troopers quickly drove him to MCH. He compliments the medical staff and officers often during an interview and talks about the calm at the hospital despite the chaos of a mass shooting on what is now called Odessa's darkest day. Quote, "Everyone was exactly where they were supposed to be, and it ran like clockwork," end quote. He said he and other shooting victims were on the 6th floor and that they were surrounded by a, quote, "fantastic staff, all of them. Nurses were wonderful, and the officers and administration were really wonderful," end quote. Dr. Donald Davenport, via email, said as a surgeon in a rural community, quote, "one would never expect to have a mass shooting," end quote. He said the thought of that just doesn't happen here is what many thought about the Permian Basin. Quote, "In one instant, that all changed and forever impacted our lives. People out doing daily activities were affected. This community will be forever bound by our reactions. First responders in the field, our police force, and our hospitals rose to heroic efforts and performed beyond expectations. We can never repay the service to humanity, love, and kindness without thought," end quote. Davenport said as a physician with the opportunity to care for an injured patient that he wanted to thank the patients. Quote, "Thank you for recognizing and thanking us. Thank you for never uttering a negative word about the circumstances that occurred. Thank you for digging deep and helping us begin a healing process, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. We can all learn from your personal experience," Davenport said. The medical center hospital doctor concluded with a good word for Joe Glide. Quote, "I hope this finds you in good health, Mr. Glide, and everyone else who was impacted," end quote. Glide spent 6 days at medical center hospital and in wound care for several weeks. He was amazed at the medical treatment and his road to recover and impressed by important visitors, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. All spent time with him and others, asking about his comfort and recovery. Glide seems reflective when speaking about ATOR. He said he still doesn't know much about how ATOR got the weapon that he used that day to terrorize the Permian Basin. Quote, "Last thing I heard was that someone in Lubbock sold him that gun. He wasn't supposed to have it. I heard he had money trouble and was going through a divorce, and that he maybe just wanted someone to kill him," end quote. He also wonders if ATOR wanted to commit suicide by cop, but also wonders aloud why he had to take so many innocent lives with him if that was the case. Born and raised in Sacramento, California, Glide is well-traveled and even spent 4 months traveling the world in his younger years. Now at age 61, he is optimistic about the future and repeatedly remarks that he is lucky. He also talks several times about the tragedy of the lives lost that day and lingers on the youngest victims. Quote, "That teenage girl? Who would shoot a teenage girl or a mail carrier or a little baby girl in her face?" End quote. Glide details that his 10 angels went to work early in his life A hernia at about 1 year old should have been fatal, but his family lived across from a hospital and he was rushed over and saved. He said he has had many, many close calls, including a car accident about 20 years ago when a car going 60 miles per hour slammed into his driver's side. He walked away with just an internal bruise on his leg, much to the amazement of first responders that day. He said he came to Odessa about 3.5 years ago and opened his own oil-filled services company that, despite less than a stellar oil prices and COVID-19, remains busy today. He said he didn't think of leaving Odessa following the August 31st mass shooting. He enjoys the area, although it is not as scenic as his native California. Quote, "I like it here. I like the people and the work." End quote. He is fortunate, he said, that the community rallied around all of those who were impacted by that day. He is thankful for the funds raised and the help with medical bills and the helping hands that reached out to him both directly after the shooting and during the year since. Quote, "It's really wonderful and uplifting to see all the support I was getting." End quote. He questions the randomness of the shootings and how he, the lucky one with angels and cat lives, had leg issues and some wound care instead of a funeral or a lengthy and painful physical recovery as others who were shot that day. He's so positive about life and his spirituality and his hopes for the future. He's thankful for that unknown Odessa Police Department officer and the DPS troopers and all the medical staff at Medical Center Hospital and the generosity of Odessans. Quote, "I was one of the blessed ones," Glad said. The victims of the mass shooting. The deceased, Lila Hernandez, age 15, of Odessa, Joe Griffith, age 40, of Odessa, Mary Granados, age 29, of Odessa, Edwin Peregrino, age 25, of Odessa, Rodolfo Julio Arco, age 57, from Odessa, Cameron Cartless Brown, age 30, of Brownwood, and Raul Garcia, age 35, of El Paso. The injured, Nathan Hernandez, age 18, of Odessa, Mark Gonzalez, age 38, from Odessa, Zachary Owens, Midland Police Department, Timothy Beard, age 55, from San Antonio, James Santana, Odessa Police Department, Glenda Dempsey, age 62, of Odessa, Marco Corral, age 62, from San Diego, California, Coy Edge, age 53, of Odessa, Joseph Glide, age 60, of Odessa, Anderson Davis, age 17 months, from Odessa, Daniel Munoz, age 28, from Yuma, Arizona, Robert Cavazos, age 38, from Alice, Texas, Maria Boado, age 27, from Hialeah, Florida, Effie Obayagbona, age 45, from Round Rock, Texas, Bradley Grimsley, age 64, from Clarksville, Texas, Chuck Pryor, Texas Department of Public Safety, Timothy Hardaway, age 54, from Brownwood, Quadri Fateh, age 41, from Houston, Jesus Alvidrez, age 21, from Gardendale, Lilia Diaz, age 46, from Odessa, Crystal Lee, age 36, from Odessa, Larry Shores, age 34, from Abilene, Colton Regina, age 9, from Odessa, Penny Moore, age 55, from Odessa, and Wanda Silvas, age 74, from Odessa.
Sets solar project taxes. Ector County Commissioners Tuesday bumped the 2020-21 tax rate to slightly higher than the current levy and told a solar energy company representative to come back in 2 weeks with a modified tax abatement plan that will pay the county an unspecified upfront fee. Precinct 2 Commissioner Greg Simmons' motion was unanimously approved to set the new rate at 36.9 cents per $100 in valuation, which is up from 36.5 cents. Origis Energy Director of Development Matthew Gomes of Miami, Florida, appeared with Odessa Chamber of Commerce Development Director Wesley Burnett to seek a 100% abatement or cessation of property taxes for the first 5 years of the company's Rockhound Solar Project south of I-20 near Penwell, west southwest of Odessa. Gomes also sought a 50% abatement for the second 5 years. County Judge Debbie Hayes said Origis had paid other counties upfront fees to offset the loss of tax revenues, and the court tabled the matter for County Attorney Dusty Gallivan to confer with Gomes and Burnett and return September 8th with a compromise. Gomes said the $600 million installation of solar panels in four phases on 26,900 acres that the company owns will require 600 construction workers next year and in 2022 and provide 10 to 15 permanent jobs. Texas needs power, said the official, adding that Origis has solar projects in 16 states. He said Odessa College trustees and directors of the County Hospital District had already granted the same abatements. In other business, Sheriff Mike Griffiths attended at Precinct 3 Commissioner Dale Childers' behest with architect Jay Bradford of JSA Architects in Odessa to say the sheriff's office needs to expand its 250-square-foot radio room and be provided more space to store evidence and records. We've got stuff on the floor, and we have records that we have to keep forever, Griffiths said. Hayes noted that such expenses hadn't been budgeted for in 2020-21, but Childers said after the 10 a.m. meeting that the cost might be added to certificates of obligation to finance the court's possible $20 million construction of a new juvenile detention center. Bradford was asked to return with a survey of the sheriff's needs, and commissioners noted that the county maintenance department might make some improvements. The court also approved a total of $1,027,290 in budget amendments for road improvements and construction, reappointed Childers to the board of the 911 Emergency Management District, accepted donations to the sheriff's office of $3,340 from the National Law Enforcement Magnets Organization and $2,500 from the Back the Badge benefit. Accepted office furniture for the health department from Keith Dial and Shafiq Tahani, with the local businessmen acknowledging applause from the audience of about 20 people. Set specifications for paper towels and bathroom tissue. Okayed an agreement for jail-based mental health services with PermiaCare. Approved an interlocal agreement with the City of Odessa for the 2020 Burn Justice Assistance Grant Program Award. Resolved to enter into a grant agreement with the Texas Department of Transportation. Enacted the county's Transportation Infrastructure Fund grant agreement with the state of Texas. Approved the 2021 Routine Airport Maintenance Grant Agreement with TxDOT for Schlemeyer Field. Okayed the TxDOT CARES Act Airport Agreement for COVID-19-related expenses. Approved a copier lease contract with CMC Business Systems. Okayed a $40,000 appropriation for medical contract services at the jail, a $400 expenditure at the library for telephone expenses, and a $4,000 appropriation for legal fees.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.